Hello to all our, I want to say about seven listeners, or maybe slightly more now that most of us have to stay at home due to coronavirus. But for this podcast, we won't talk about that. It's about putting your mind onto something else and hopefully learn something new. I am Siri, a PhD student at the Natural History Museum in Berlin. And during the time of recording this podcast, I was doing a research visit, a so-called secondment at the Natural History Museum in Paris to gain insight into their exhibition practices.
And I'm Milena. I'm a PhD student at the University of Exeter in the UK. And during this podcast, I realized I have exactly one tone of voice. So if you're cool with that, stay tuned to hear me and Siri in conversation with Andreas Heinl, who is a professor at the University of Bergen. We recorded this podcast last month in Paris at a meeting of the EvoCell Network, and we asked Andy about a bunch of things, about his research interests, about blood, organs, body cavities, early stages of animal evolution, crumb jellies, PhD life, open science, politics, books, and a host of other things. So stay tuned and enjoy. We're here today at one of the EvoCell grad schools in Paris, and the conversation that we're having is with Andy Heinl, who is a group leader and a professor at the University of Bergen.
I'm Andreas Heinl, or often called Andy Heinl, and I'm the comparative developmental biologist and work in Norway. And so I was always, from childhood on, interested in animals, and later became interested in how animals develop. And so this was also my hobby when I was a child and young. And so I'm happy that I'm still doing this and now get even salary for this and sometimes some research money so that I can live for my whole hobby, which I had when I was a child.
It's great to talk to someone who loves what they do.
A dream.
Yeah.
Do you just want to tell us about your research in three sentences? Like, sell it to us.
Okay. So, I want to understand where the organ systems in animals come from and how they originated, at what time in evolution. And this includes also the human organ systems. For example, at the moment I study how the kidney evolved and how the blood evolved.
And you research that using all sorts of exotic model organisms that are not human. Which ones are they? How many models do you have in the lab, actually? It's plenty.
Yeah, other people say when they use the term phyla, I do 16 phyla, and I have published about 16 phyla of 36 existing groups like this. And I have to do this to really pin down at what nodes in the phylogenetic tree these organs evolved and how they looked like at that time in the past. And I have to study these different animals to really understand it better, at what time point, what organ, how it looked like.
And how did you get interested in studying organs? It's something very specific.
So, I mean, animals are composed out of organs, and these organs make animals functional. And I was always interested in animals. So when I was 5 years old, the word after mama and papa was Ameiser, because I saw these ants. It's a German
ants.
Word, Ameiser. Ant,
mm-hmm.
Not aunt. This would
yeah.
be
aunt. Yeah.
But I saw them crawling, and then I wanted to know the name. And another word was Gurki. Or cucumber, because I like to eat cucumbers. But this is off topic. But from childhood on, I loved animals and also caterpillars. And I was collecting caterpillars and tried to get a beautiful butterfly out of these caterpillars. But then I was a bit disappointed when always a boring brown moth hatched after like 14 days or so.
Is this why you switched to marine organisms, because they have cooler larvae?
No, I switched to marine animals because most animal groups are in the ocean.
That's true.
And only few made it on land or even into the air. But the main evolution of organ systems happened in the ocean. And so I have to study marine animals to understand this.
When you say most evolution of organs happen in the sea, have you pinpointed certain organs when they originated? What time, like how many million years ago? Or?
So I'm working on this still. It's, for example, the brain. I want to find out how often a brain evolved and how did it look like at that time and from what did it evolve. So I study animals which only have a very simple brain, but within this group of animals, a more complex brain has also evolved. So it's an independent evolution of a brain-like structure. And this I can compare with other animals, and then I can say, okay, these neurons, for example, were present at the beginning, and then from these neurons, by division or something like this, a more complex, higher number of neurons and complex interactions evolved. And the same is with, so how did the excretory organ look like? So the kidney, you cannot imagine as a human kidney being present in these marine animals. It was a very simple system, likely composed out of only a handful of cells, but they did its job. And I know the clade where the first nephridia or kidneys evolved, and animals before, they did it without kidneys.
And which ones are they? But for the kidneys and the brain, which group gave you the most information about the origins of these
so
systems?
So these are the acyllomorph flatworms, or not flatworms anymore, but acyls. The name comes from that they don't have body cavities inside. So coelom would be a body cavity, and acyl means without coelom. And these animals are marine, mostly marine. There's only one or two freshwater species. And they are in an interesting position in the evolutionary tree of life, where they are highly informative for understanding the beginning of the organ systems, which are also present in humans and flies, for example.
We were told to ask you about body cavities, and then you mentioned the body cavities as well in your talk yesterday. And yeah, I do want to know what you think is the big significance of the appearance of bodily cavities in evolution.
It is always when you have these body cavities, which are then coeloms, they are used to bring instability into the body. So you can put it under pressure, internal pressure, so it stabilizes the body. For example, in these nematodes, these worms, this cavity, which is not a true coelom, but this cavity is under pressure. And when you poke a hole into the worm, they explode. And the other function is that you can... You subdivide these body cavities along the body, and then you can make it flexible, and then these worms can, for example, burrow in the sand better. And these would be annelids, for example, the lukeworms and stuff, and earthworms, as we know, they dig into the sand.
So does the evolution of segmentation, was it enabled by the appearance of body cavities or vice versa?
So there is an old idea that this is a very strong connection, that the emergence of body cavities is together with the ability to perform specific movements. But this idea is not so favored anymore. So segmentation has been seen as more like the ability to subdivide a body into units, and these units can carry different functions. For example, when you look at a crayfish, these have in each segment different kinds of legs. They have the claws in the front and the walking legs in the back, and gills in the very far back.
I want to segue into unpopular opinions, because we did invite you here for clickbait, because we know that you have some unpopular opinions within the field. Would you like to share interesting topics of conflict when it comes to major events in animal evolution?
So there are some opinions about where animals belong to in the tree, and this is one of the debated topics, but they usually get solved with time, right? And there are less and less of these debated topics. And I'm coming from a generation which took these problems very emotional, I think, but now the next generation of scientists is less biased from these old ideas, what they learned in, for example, in the university, because I learned a specific tree, and then this tree was turned over completely with using molecules. And then you have to digest this, that you have learned, for example, something completely wrong, and the teacher even more of a problem that they were teaching something wrong. And I went through the last 30 years of time where many scientists were fighting, and I could observe very well how some new hypothesis emerged, and it's at the end just a debate. One shouldn't say it's maybe a democratic decision of what is the right theory, what is the wrong theory, but this can change by having good data, which convinces the majority about a specific tree, for example.
Yeah, I just recently read about the Kuhn's theory, I think it's called. It's a philosopher, and he was describing often how it's like a circle where you have first you have a calm time within science, and then suddenly there's something contradicting, like a kind of a crisis, and then this crisis is trying to get resolved, and by I don't know how it was exactly, but you have like all these contradicting findings. There's a crisis, and then slowly people find come onto the same path again, and then it gets calmer again, and then there's a calm phase of science again, and then it's just like this crisis and calm phase is constantly it's shifting.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just one view. I think other historians would say there's less of crisis, but it's a continuous change.
Yeah, I mean, it is this Thomas Kuhn who talked about this paradigm shifts.
Yes, exactly.
And
that's what I mean.
For example, we know now that evolutionary theory, this is a major paradigm shift in biology, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have these, I wouldn't call it paradigm shift, but you have these small developments really with better technologies, and you have to get rid of old ideas because they have been simply proven wrong. And you can investigate also these changes, and you can detect the human bias which led to the wrong ideas from the past. And but also now the tree, what we think is the more or less correct one, we can also let a new technique develop, and it might be the wrong tree again. Right, so we don't know, and this is what my PhD father Gerhard Scholz, for example, said. Yeah, okay, you are convinced that this tree is right, but just let a new technique emerge, and then it might be completely different. And we have to be open for these events, and we have to keep our eyes open. But a little bit of traditionalism, I think, is also okay to not accept and jump always to a new theme.
Yeah, some stability is needed. And I mean, when I said conflict, I don't know if that will sound wrong to anyone who's listening who is outside of the field, but it's actually, to me at least, the atmosphere looks rather open and friendly, and all the discussions that I hear from people having diverging opinions, they're always done on friendly terms, and everyone seems like they're listening to each other, which I don't know if that is endemic for our field, and I hope it isn't, because it is quite a nice collaborative atmosphere that we have.
So to this, I mean, the thing is that we have now, of course, people who went, when you get older, you get this Altersgelassenheit.
Of which course means, the Germans have a word for it.
Which means that you get a little bit relaxed about things when you are getting older and older, right? You don't see the effort in robbing your own nerves about some things. So I can observe this in myself, and so I say, okay, well, let's see how things go, right, with the next generation, who will produce the major new data and advancements in the field. And when I see that they are open and relaxed, I can also relax. And I see this development because they are much more curious about to solve problems and not to stick to their own old ideas, right? Because, for example, Max Planck said also that he lived in these old days where people were fighting, and he said, like, science progresses from funeral to funeral, which means the people who carry them, some ideas, they will, yeah, be extinct.
At some point, yeah.
Are there any systemic problems in science that you're passionate about?
In general, so what I'm interested in personally is always, so how do ideas propagate, and how are ideas created? And so this is in line with Thomas Kuhn and also Ludwig Fleck. I was reading and also giving courses of these at Humboldt University about how get facts created, and how, I mean, it sounds a little bit contradictory, facts created, but there is a system of how ideas propagate, and to analyze this is fun, right? To, for example, trace the history back of some of the major problems in animal phylogeny. So when suddenly the molecular data came and created the clade Ecdysozoa, so the molting animals. And this was so many people were affected by this, because the teachers in the universities didn't know anymore what is right, what is wrong. They doubted this, and only by adding more data and a community, not agreements, or so nobody was voting, but you can see how an idea proceeds. And this is the same with other ideas. It's not only phylogeny, it is about how did major organ systems originate and things like this. So you can see how things changed and what it takes. Like the TINO4 sponge problem, right?
It's, that was about this.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things I contributed to this trouble. Right, we were the first in 2008 who published the paper. We couldn't believe our own data set, really.
Could you explain the problem?
So it was like for many years, like nearly 100 years, people were thinking that sponges, which are sessile animals on the ocean, which have no real, they have cell boundaries, but no real strong cell connections, which are in more complex animals. And the idea was that these simple, rather simple animals are the sister group to all remaining animals. So our furthest cousin, let's say, who is living on this planet. But then molecular phylogenies and our attempt of using many genes to resolve animal phylogeny, especially in the between the more complex groups, suddenly turned out and placed these comb jellies, which are very complex animals, which swim through the oceans, are predators. Suddenly they went to the base of the tree. And this was, we couldn't believe it, right? When we saw these data sets, the first results, and we said, okay, we need another of these comb jellies. And we added one more, still same result. And we added another one, and still same result. And then this article got published in Nature, and we wanted to discuss in the paper segmentation. But then one reviewer said, segmentation is boring, and the evolution of segmentation. So why don't you talk about this new thing? And so they made us talk about it, and it was just half of a sentence where we also wrote, like, more data, this needs to be better investigated before this can be called a case. And this is also has something to do with evolutionary thinking, because when we had these data sets, we said, of course, what if this result is correct? What does it mean? And then evolutionary thinking turned in, because the comb jellies who live today have as far from our last common ancestor with humans. So they have spent the same time on this planet. So all recent animal species have been on this planet at the same time from their last ancestors as we are, right?
Yeah, that's an important thing.
And so this means that why should evolution stop in one specific lineage, and that they should stay primitive? And who is making these decisions even? No, evolution happens along all lineages continuously throughout animal history. So this answers, why shouldn't have an animal a nervous system which is as far as away as we are? And this is also like more a ladder-like thinking, which has nothing to do with evolution. Evolution is tree thinking, and you need to understand how these groups branch.
Do we have an estimation how long ago Tina first diverged?
So it's not my field of expertise. Yeah. I usually see the tree, but today we saw the presentation from Graham Butt, and it's getting earlier and earlier. So now it's even before the Ediacaran. So it is very interesting what's going on in the paleontology, because they found more and more fossils, and the dating of the fossils is getting back better and better. So that the Cambrian explosion, for example, is a term what many people use, did not even happen in the Cambrian. It happened before, right? And this we know now, if there was even an explosion. I doubt a little bit, but...
How do you?
Now, well, I would not call it explosion when something suddenly hard-shelled fossils appeared. I mean, it's like a biomineralization event across lineages, and this is what can be, but Graham likely would correct me here.
So I think we already talked about it now before, but I also mentioned it that the scientific practice was very reductionist, and it's still very reductionist in tone in general, like throughout the 20th century. And sometimes I think doing science, you often forget maybe the bigger whole, or like a more of a holistic view. What is your opinion on it?
Yeah, for my own science, I always try to address bigger questions, which are my interest, right? I don't want to solve problems which I'm not interested in. And do this with the best approach. So then I don't lose the bigger picture, mm-hmm. because the question is connected to the bigger picture. And therefore, I don't get detached, no matter what single molecule is expressed here or there, right? Because it's you look at the data, okay, this is not informative, so why not another one, right? And then suddenly you discover things which are, whoa, that's surprising, right? Or this worked out well, this project. And because when you, for example, study blood evolution and then get really messy, not messy data, but it's not well interpretable, which is also not really surprising, because from the tree we know that blood likely evolved several times independently. So I shouldn't expect there really a consistent pattern of all the molecules being present in all blood, right? So, but then when we did the excretory organs and all bilaterian or animals which have a left and right side in their body, they have all excretory organs. So it's not surprising to find also they are then consistent genes patterning these systems. So it goes hand in hand, right? And one is the evolution of kidney. And then you can dive in more details when you want to understand. So how does from excretory organ of 5 cells suddenly an organ evolved of thousands of cells in, for example, the chordates, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always, for me, a bigger picture. It's sometimes, I mean, you as a PhD student, you always play a small role in these sets, right? And this is the thing. So when you start your PhD, you have to show that you can deal with a scientific project. And then you get your title, and then you go on, and then you have to show that you can do many things. And then during the career, you can detach from the very, very small things. So to a person like me, who is a group leader and who can get the horses running for specific projects, right? And but still, the work has to be done with it's only a minor wheel in the whole system, right? In the bigger picture.
Thank you for calling us minor wheels. That's really wonderful to hear.
I was also minor wheeled.
I know. Do you ever miss being a minor wheel and doing experiments and lab stuff?
How was your PhD life? How was the time for PhD?
Yeah, this was an exciting time, right? So it was in Berlin. So I moved from my hometown Bremen to study biology in Berlin, and this was just shortly after the wall came down. And so Berlin was an extremely exciting place to be. And so you harvest the fruits of what Berlin can offer you. And in addition, I was also a political activist at that time. So I had many things to do during my PhD, which was also not related to science. So in principle, I was working from morning, like 9 o'clock, until 11, 12 in the evening. But the whole evening work and weekend work as well was politics. And during the day, it was a bit of science.
What was the most exciting thing you did in your political career?
This I cannot talk about. But it is, I think, it would be fair yet, let me say, but...
Okay.
So, I mean, topics. it was always against Nazis and anti-fascist action, but... No more details.
But staying a bit on it, do you think scientists need to become a bit more political?
Especially, yes. Yeah. Yes, because if you are not political, you are still political. Mm-hmm. So the inactivity of scientists is, of course, supporting those who want to do change to the worst, right? I mean, we face now worldwide this less accepted role of scientists. I mean, of course, with the climate movement, we have a huge young generation who respects the scientists and the scientific results, but then we have authoritarian characters which try to eliminate the science. So then scientists have to speak up, right? But also there, I mean, I always want to point out, we were discussing Kuhn and Fleck before, that scientists also should not over interpret their search for the truth, right? Because at the end, we try to we collect data from the outer world, and we have to be aware that we don't have a direct or we don't produce gold or something like this, but the scientific method we should transport and keep up. And there we have to be connected. If we disconnect to this scientific method, we become less credible. And this is important, for example, when you explain trees, animal phylogeny and evolution, you should stick to the science, and not when you popularize science suddenly to make it more sensational, lose the scientific method, right? When you overinterpret your data, and this is dangerous.
Are there any other fields that you're interested in, something completely unrelated to anything that you're working on? Like, I'm sure you read science papers that are not in evolution, or maybe not even in biology, just for fun. Do you have full-time job, I guess?
No, I mean, you mean what else I'm reading also?
Yeah.
But still politics and history books.
Yeah.
So this is so I don't read belletristic. I don't read biographies of other people. Maybe, sometimes, but also it's a minor thing.
I Who's think biographies I'm, have you read?
This Goethe.
Okay.
Karl Marx.
But that's super interesting because Goethe, he did practice science, and he had some really interesting views on the practices of sciences and
these Germans.
Yeah. And how broadly people were doing things back then.
Yeah, they did many, many things at the same time. So I don't do many, many things. I don't play an instrument and
yeah,
I consume music. This is what I'm doing. And
But I definitely think, like, since I started reading into the history of science, I'm just thinking, wow, why didn't I start earlier? It's such a...
Like in the 19th century?
No, like, why wasn't it part of my my education? Why wasn't it part of my bachelor's or master's? Yeah, it does make you appreciate it more, like the all the legacy in which we stand is. But it also makes you kind of question a bit more how you practice science maybe nowadays, and makes your mind a bit more open maybe how to change things.
Yeah.
What do you think we need to make in science better?
Ah.
Do you have any good ideas?
Many. No, what is a good development is that the open science is proceeding and is also used more broadly. So also the bioarchive to have preprints published, which is speeds up science intensively. And what is another side effect of it is that the appreciation of high impact journals and politics around high impact journals is getting less and less. Although this is a big problem in science, right? Because many people say, yeah, we don't put so much effort on in which journal it is published, but often the people say it, but at the end they look on the CV in which journals it was published. So there is a little bit split in the community, and often it's the people who have already the high impact papers, then they start suggesting maybe we should not develop a fetish around these high impact journals. But you can say this easily when you have your position and permanent position, then you can do whatever, right? But the young generation, this is still a problem. And to find a good way how to evaluate the scientists, young researchers, in a not biased way, which goes toward impact factor and high impact journals. But also here, many people try to change it in that, yeah, we read their papers if the papers are of high quality. But the thing is that the best experts in the scientific field are the authors of these publications. So how does somebody else evaluate the quality of a scientific product? Is it measured based on the amount of data? Is it measured about the interpretation or the story? So this is a big problem, and I have no solution for this. But open science could go towards this direction, right? Mm-hmm. And so there could be a change of scientific culture, but this will take many, many, many years.
And what do you think about the time we're having nowadays? So it's expected that we publish more and more papers in a short amount of time. Like for example, Darwin took him like until the first drawing of his tree diagram, 22 years until he published his theory on evolution.
It is that there is a change of funding agencies that they, for example, German Science Foundation, that you have only a limited amount of publications you should list in your proposals. So that means you only put five or so, which are the most important things which are related to the topic of your science. So you don't attach a CV with 100 publications anymore. And if you are not... if you don't have to do this, if you don't have to hit the 100 papers or so, you might not have the idea to do 100 papers, and you maybe fuse different data sets into one publication instead of making three out of it, right? And this trend should stop or should be changed, because it's also not good for the reader, because the reader has to read three papers. With the same material and methods, and if you can combine it intelligently into one publication, then it's better.
So the last thing that we wanted to ask you is about the exciting new directions that you will have in your research, like what we can look forward to in the coming years.
Now, well, I just got a grant about brain evolution, but I'm at the moment I'm thinking more about in which direction I want to go, or something new, or going back to my roots, or what I really love. And what I always found fascinating are cell lineages. So So how do cell lineages evolve? So because different animals make different cell divisions during their embryogenesis, and there are some which had a lot of changes during their evolution, that you have a very dynamic changes in the cell lineage. Others, for example, the spiralians, are highly conserved in this cell lineage. So this could be a topic which is, I mean, and now I have a permanent position which might not be so interesting for many other people, but I'm interested in it. And another field is with some collaborators, what we were thinking about is the evolution of morphogenesis.
That is a big one.
And this is, of course, something which has not been tackled so much in the past. So you have all the data from the model systems, like how, for example, different cells shape to make a structure, like tubes, or, for example, neurulation. Or let's take a simple process, gastrulation. But which shape changes in cells have to happen, and how did this change on the course of evolution? And this you can tackle with light sheet microscopy, biophysics, and so this is a big thing, which I hope it works out with my collaborators, and this is the shape of life.
So no, how, that's catchy. No, that's
good. Yeah, how is shape made, and how did the different shapes evolve, and what shapes are possible and which are not possible, and these mechanisms and units which might enable a cell to change their shape, how often did they evolve, what are these mechanisms, and etc., etc.
Cool.
There you have it, guys. Professor Andy Heinl from the University of Bergen, spilling knowledge and inspiration and fresh perspectives. Time is always limited, and we definitely had much more to ask, so we hope we can get him to talk to us again in the future.
Question for the listeners. What would you ask Andy or the other experts on evolution and development that we plan to speak to in the future? But for now, we hope you learned something new, and even more that you stay safe and healthy.
Me and Siri were talking about how to make the best out of self-isolation and working from home, and we do hope we'll be able to bring you more content in the coming weeks, maybe talking with our network members about how they're coping with the pandemic, and also exchanging thoughts on how the future of science and scientific collaborations will change due to this massive and shocking disruption. Until then, thank you for listening. Share your thoughts on our website and on social media. And again, stay safe.